Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
Hey, everyone. It's Asten Herndon, political reporter for The New York Times. When I became a journalist, I made a promise to my readers, like the way that doctors take an oath to their patients. I committed to bringing the truth to light, no matter which party, business, organization, or person I'm reporting on. I have to be persistent. I have to do research, and I have to push back when someone tries to hide or spin the facts. And I know I'm going to write stories that both Democrats and Republicans don't like. But that's what The New York Times has been doing for more than a century, and that's what we're going to keep doing. We believe the public deserves the right to make up their mind based on the facts. So if you want to support this kind of work, you can subscribe to The New York Times at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Chica, ¿qué dices? Saoko, papi, saoko.
Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your It's Not Worth Your Knuckles of music, news, and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica. You're listening to Saoko by Rosalía. Rosalía just put out her third album. It's called Motomami. It's the first album since El Mal Querer, which was in 2018, which was her big breakout album. If you follow podcasts, I'm sure you know Rosalía was someone who studied traditional flamenco when she was younger, put out a flamenco record that very much was in a classic style with light flourishes of innovation. And then on her second album, did a much more adventurous take on the genre and somehow became a global phenomenon. We will get into that. Motomami is her third album, coming out on the heels of several singles over the last couple of years that have radically expanded and remade her sound and also kind of put her at the center of some controversies about appropriation and what kind of music certain people are allowed to make or are encouraged to make or perhaps should be discouraged from making. Motomami is an extremely dynamic pop record. It's very complicated, a lot of unusual juxtapositions. The contributor list is long, and frankly, it's like weird in a good way. I want to go out and say that. There's Frank Dukes, Noah Goldstein, Q-Tip is background vocals on some songs, Pharrell, Chad, Larry Gold. A favorite of mine, Caroline Shaw, is all over this record. Shout out Caroline Shaw. Soulja Boy, Soe Tiet, who is a Vietnamese TikTok singer. There's a Burial sample, and there's also a Joe Coscarelli feature. Not on the album, though. Joe recently flew to the promised land of Los Angeles to have an audience with Rosalía, and Joe's here. Hello, Joe. The album's out. What's really good, Blair?
We should just get this out of the way. So you're not going to be rolling your R's for this podcast?
Honestly, the only place that I'd be rolling them is to my own grave. Let's just keep it a buck.
Let's do an apology off top for pronunciation. Myself especially.
That's true. What would your abuela say about your poor pronunciation?
Abuelita, lo siento, perdón, you know, all that. I'm sorry.
Is that a first? Forgive me. First time you've spoken Spanish on podcast?
Someone will correct us if I've dropped a little before, but no.
Okay. Wow. Okay. Well.
So you guys can't say Rosalía?
Oh!
I mean, look, if Jimmy Fallon can do it, but yeah, our apologies should extend to Pedro as
yes,
well.
Yes, that is accurate. Pedro, can you soundboard you rolling the R in Rosalía?
And that would just be my pleasure.
You can just superimpose it every time that we butcher it. You could just superimpose it.
I could say it like a Mexican announcer too.
If you want to just pop in and correct us on any and all pronunciations.
You did fine, Joe. You did fine, Jose.
Thank you.
We're not precious, much like Rosalía. frankly.
It's true. I had this conversation with her, you know, about my Spanish. Her English, I will say, has radically improved in the last few years. First time I interviewed her was for Diary of a Song over FaceTime when Con Altura came out. And she spoke English very well, I thought, in that video. But this time she was, I think, able to express much more complicated thoughts in English. She's obviously a very intelligent person, but she has some self-consciousness lingering about it. But it was fun to tell her, you know, just basically, if there's something you would rather say in Spanish, just say it in Spanish and I'll deal with it later. And I'll understand most of it. I understand a lot of Spanish. My grammar is not great. So we had that, you know, a very bilingual conversation. She is more bilingual than I am. But it's interesting to be able to speak to someone like her in that way, because I feel like, again, it is also reflected in the art, where you get a lot of Spanglish, you get a lot of slang from across the Spanish-speaking world.
And Rosalia being someone who very deliberately is working inside and outside of those traditions, is claiming traditions that are from where she's from, are claiming traditions that are not from where she's from, and also trying to yank some of those sounds into unlikely and unexpected juxtapositions with musical frameworks from the non-Spanish-speaking world.
Yeah, the only thing I'd say to that is, like, we should discuss whether or not she is trying to claim any of this as her own.
Is there a distinction we can make between claim and, like, lay claim to? Maybe that's a little bit of a semantic fudging.
Yeah.
But feeling, again, these are all loaded words, entitled, within her rights, within her creative remit, to experiment, borrow, and create widely. That she does, and based on what she told you in the interview. So claim, yes, maybe claim is a strong word, but I'm not sure it's far from the truth.
Totally. And I think that is something I was really interested in after I heard this album front to back and then was preparing to go speak with her, you know, spend some time with it first, spend a lot of time poring over the credits. As you said, they're quite complex and interesting and unexpected. And then sitting down with her, we actually listened to the album front to back and talked about it as we went, which I don't do with a lot of musicians. I have not done with a lot of musicians, but she is someone, frankly, who wants to expound upon all of her references and influences. I think, tell me if you've had this experience, I think there's really two kinds of musicians, a lot of whom, most of whom I would say, hold their references, their direct influences, the things they were thinking of while working on a specific song, they hold it very close to the vest and don't like to talk about what sounds like what and are insulted by that.
And also certainly not in this incredibly litigious era, like,
yes,
compounded. Absolutely.
Yes. And then on the flip side, someone like Rosalía, I've found to be extraordinarily both generous and intrigued by conversation about what sounds like what she's going for at any given moment, you know, from the sound of a snare or a piano or a vocal line to a more obvious sample or reference or stylistic borrowing. She's very open and explicit about who she is stealing from, if you want to call it stealing.
But here's what the credits tell me. And again, if it's laying a claim, I feel like there are people for whom the specific word choices are more powerful than necessarily how I feel about it. But what I see when I'm reading these credits and when I'm listening to this album, it really marks Rosalía as someone who is a listener. And I don't mean in a casual sense. Like, here's a person who seeks out an unusual sample. Here's a person who's looking at a TikTok. I don't know if it's on her feed or if it's on somebody else's feed, but is looking at a TikTok, hearing it not simply as a passive consumer of like, oh, that's a fascinating thing, and then swipe up. Oh, that's something I might be able to interrogate. That's something I might be able to engage with. That's something I might be able to incorporate. And that's something that I agree, there are a lot of musicians who think that way, but there aren't necessarily a lot of musicians who want to show you the scenes, who want to show you the parts. And I think she really does. I want to briefly, before we get too deep into the album, I want to jump back briefly to the prior era. When Rosalía played Webster Hall, she played two nights. To me, that was like one of the best concerts I've been to in the last 5 years. And the thing that really jumped out at me and kind of spoke to a low-hanging concern that I've always had about the Rosalía breakthrough, which is I was fearful, and there were some of the singles that came after that I think, led that reinforced this fear that they were essentially going to pop star her in an uninteresting way.
We talked about this a lot as it was happening.
Yeah, Katy Perry. I mean, again, not that she would make actual... I mean, I'm using Katy Perry, and forgive me, I don't know what Katy Perry fans are called, but whatever, forgive me. I'm using her as a kind of stand-in for...
Katy Katz,
I think. Sure.
Anyway, cool. Keep going.
Phenomenal. I wish all Katy Katz a very happy don't listen to this section of podcast. I'm using Katy as a stand-in for a... not particularly musically adventurous, not particularly lyrically adventurous pop star who is big in a way that even that can't derail necessarily. And like, please don't start telling me about the weird Katy Perry trap songs. I don't want to hear about it. To me, Rosalia is Bjork. She's not Katy Perry. She's Bjork. And that show at Webster Hall was radical. It was complicated. It was deeply rooted in tradition. But it was also more interesting than like an FKA Twigs show or something, you know? Very, very advanced. Really, like, I could have seen that 7 nights in a row and never gotten bored. The singles that followed El Mal Querer, hit or miss.
The scariest thing that ever happened to Rosalia is a song with Travis Barker. Sorry.
Whoa!
Wow.
Actually, that would hit. That would hit.
And it will happen, probably.
It will happen. It's probably already happened.
You know, I meant Travis Scott.
Yes, yes. But a Travis, for the record, if anybody is listening and would like to put Rosalia on a song with Travis Barker, we accept it. Maybe not with MGK, though.
What I want is Travis Barker to send Rosalia a drum kit, a kit of sounds, and to let her chop them up, which is what she did all over this album. You know, take other people's percussion and then chop it up herself.
Can we take a break so I can go get on my Cannibal Corpse t-shirt? Can I go just to finish the episode?
Anyway, I misspoke, but yes, a song with Travis Scott seemed like a warning shot about where Rosalia's career might have gone.
Let's listen to just briefly, really briefly. It's called TKN. Does it sound like anything? I don't think it sounds like anything. Whatever. Let's listen to like literally 1.5 seconds of this song. Okay, now that we've shaken that off, I actually was more concerned. There was another collaboration she did that I personally found more concerning. You mentioned Con Altura, which, depending on the day, sometimes I really like, sometimes I really don't like. What I think, even on the days where I like that record, it does seem like a comically simple record for a very complicated artist. It's collaboration with J Balvin. J Balvin is maybe in his flop era. This is like a good J Balvin record that is a strange Rosalia record, I always felt. However, the collaboration that always rubbed me a little bit wrong was actually the Ozuna collaboration that came the next year, which is called Yo Ti To Me, I think. Let's listen to a little bit of this Ozuna record. This is like the arm wrestling, black fist, white fist meme. It's like people who don't want Rosalia to make kind of like straightforward, non-complicated records on one side. And on the other side, it's people who are not interested in a white Catalan woman making straight ahead reggaeton records.
Right.
This song is like the union where both of those groups of people can be like, this is not it. We do not. And that was a source of concern on my end, because I'm like, if this is the future, this is the Katy Perry version, in my mind, of where it could have gone.
Or it's J Balvin. J Balvin is the path.
Yes, and that was stressful, because it just seemed like it would be leaving so much creativity on the table. When you guys were talking, how much did you talk about this kind of like interregnum period and about her? Because I can never quite tell, was this like a, it's a Drake Lucy era, or was this a, I'm trial ballooning these sort of songs?
we did talk about it, and it's interesting because what I learned was that she's the type of artist who only works on songs that she finishes. She does not have dozens or hundreds of records lying around, which a lot of artists in this era do. When she starts something, she tends to finish it, is what she told me. And she said that she went into each of these songs sort of thinking that they were for the album and sort of working it out in real time.
These collaborations.
Basically, put out, what, like 10 or a dozen singles probably in the 4 years between El Mar Querer and Motomami. She thought maybe that all of these songs were for the album, but she didn't know exactly what the album was yet. And I think then once they were put out, she was like, that's not it. You know, and she was sort of, in a Drake-like way, I think Drake probably tries way more things that we don't hear, though there was a period when we were hearing a lot of it.
And also, frankly, the Drake Lucy serves a slightly different purpose, which is to keep him credible more at the fringes, not at the center, whereas her Lucy's, insofar as these, her Lucy's actually served to kind of like shore up some kind of like pop centricity while freeing her up to make a weird album, basically.
That's interesting, although I don't totally agree, because there are a lot of songs that she put out in between that are not the Ozuna record, right? There's Millonaria, that one, a couple in that period, which felt like they were the beginning of a new album era, but didn't end up coming to fruition. There's Dolerme, which is the ballad that she put out during peak COVID. And those are not pop-centric records. I think her sort of single strategy really reminded me most of Billie Eilish, who, before she even put out a full-length album, was releasing a lot of singles that weren't going anywhere, and did it again in between the last two, where you were sort of like, okay, what exactly is she doing here? But I think what Rosalía figured out in that way, and Conatura is actually, I think, a real turning point for her creatively, in that she decided, like, these Latin sounds, urbano, like whatever you want to call the umbrella term for present day Latin music, reggaeton, dembow, etc. She was comfortable in that palette. But I think in all the ways that that song is straightforward, this album, Motomami, is not. She took that, she seemingly got comfortable. That one also was produced and featured El Guincho, who was her main collaborator on the last album, who is, you know, here and there on the credits of this one, but was not her main studio partner this time around. And I think what you see is that she set the tone with a lot of these and then went totally left.
How mindful did you find her to be about the distinction between doing something that's like a more straightforward read, like the Ozuna collaboration and the Balvin collaboration, and doing the reggaeton-esque records, which are not every record by any means on Motomami, but the ones that are? What does she talk about in terms of articulating an aesthetic distinction between one kind and the other kind?
She talked about risk. She said, you know, I think I quoted her saying, like, I only want to put out stuff that I haven't heard before. And even when these are the most referential songs or even straight up covers, she then adds something to the mix that totally destabilizes it. And, you know, she said flat out, it would be way less risky if I just put out songs with normal structures, with choruses and verses, and that followed a blueprint. But what you hear here on this album is every time you're comfortable in something, it switches gears again.
Can we talk just briefly before we get further into the record? You mentioned Billie Eilish. To me, maybe the most uncharacteristic, besides a Travis song, most uncharacteristic collaboration that Rosalía put out in this kind of intermediate period was, it's called Lo Vas a Olvidar. It's a duet with Billie Eilish. Let's listen to a little bit of this. Lo vas a olvidar, can you let it go? Can you let it go? Lo vas a olvidar, can you let it go? Lo vas a olvidar, lo vas a olvidar, can you let it go? Can you let it go? Lo vas a olvidar, can you let it go? Lo vas a olvidar. Do you like this or no? I have a separate question about it, but I'm just like low key. Like I'm mixed to negative on this.
I like it in Euphoria, which is, I think, what it was for and where it ended up. But I don't listen to it on my own, though I do think they did an interesting thing on this collaboration. They could have made a bad guy type again, straight ahead record. And they made something very quiet, very strange. I think you blurbed it on Playlist and gave it a positive review because it was like not exactly what you were expecting from them.
Right. And this is sort of the question, because when I was looking at, okay, we have the Travis collaboration, we have the Billy collaboration, we have two Weekend collaborations, we have the Tokisha record from before, and then also the Tokisha record that's on the album. For an artist like Rosalía, what is a collaboration for? And what do we want from a Rosalía collaboration? Do we want an artist like her to bring what we understand to be her signature approach into somebody else's house? Do we want her to try a different thing? This is ultimately why the Billy thing is like, it's not totally satisfying. Because it's like, it's not a great Rosalía record, and it's not quite Rosalía doing Billy. And even if it was Rosalía doing Billy, maybe we don't want that. I don't know. But what function do we as listeners want from these collaborations? And why does she choose to do these kind of specific duets?
I think she only brings people into her house, especially post these singles and as you get into what Motomami is and the album. You know, it's interesting. She considers there to be only two features on the album, which are the Tokisha verse and the Weekend verse, right? They both have full verses. You hear James Blake's voice on the album. You hear Pharrell's voice on the album. But those, to her, are just accents. You know, those are, I think she considers everyone she works with part of a toolkit. In that way, and like, this sounds...
It's Kanye.
Yeah, it's Kanye and it's Beyonce. And like, to me, the albums that this Motomami record is most similar to are Yeezus and Lemonade. And like, if that sounds lofty, like that's the level that she's aspiring to. Whether or not you think she's achieving it is a different question, but like she is playing at that level.
So, okay. I think this record's excellent. I think it's sonically inconsistent, but it is not inconsistent as an album. It's a coherent record that has distinct sections and movements, which is actually very much how the last album, in a much more formalized way, was constructed. There is a bit kind of in the early part, maybe the only section that makes me kind of like itch a tiny bit is that chicken teriyaki to hentai movement. And this is, again, to kind of go back to the Ozuna song. So Chicken Teriyaki is written in part by Rauw Alejandro, who is, I believe, her romantic partner.
Yes, though the way we discussed it, she gave an example specifically, which was, I will put my boyfriend's name in the credits if he comes on and is messing around with my computer and like mutes one snare or like gives me one line suggestion. She's like, those people are in the credits. Like my friend's mom came to the studio. She said, you know, XYZ and she's in the credits, you know? So like, I wouldn't overstate anybody's role on these songs. I think it's very piecemeal in that way.
Rauw has at least one writing credit and at least one production credit, maybe two. Or additional production credit. But these two songs are, you know, if you have anxiety about Rosalía's pop ambitions, these would be the songs where you'd be like, okay. But I like that they are clustered together. I like that they are, well, let's listen to Chicken Teriyaki. Rosa, sin tarjeta, se lo mando a tu gata, te la tengo con roleta, no hizo falta, serenata, salgo yo una balacera, me visto de cualquier manera.
This year, a very important public figure turns 80. He sent us his wish for his birthday.
My wish is for everyone to practice wildfire safety, because only you can prevent wildfires.
That sounds easy enough. Bet you don't know who it is. Nah, of course you do. It's Smokey Bear. Let's all make sure Smokey's wish comes true by learning his wildfire prevention tips at SmokeyBear.com. Because Smokey Bear lives within us all. Brought to you by the USDA Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council.
This is A.O. Scott. I'm a critic at the New York Times. What I do and what the other critics here do is part of the same project that all of the journalists at the New York Times work on every day, to give you clarity and perspective, and above all, a deeper understanding of the world. When you subscribe to the New York Times, it's not just here are the headlines, but here's the way everything fits together. If you'd like to subscribe, please go to nytimes.com/subscribe.
Hentai comes next. Hentai is like a very sexually provocative song.
Yeah, we should talk about that, because I think that hentai and Chicken Teriyaki are very different.
All right, talk about hentai. Production on hentai, A+.
Yeah, so this is a collaboration with the Neptunes, with Pharrell mainly.
And I think Chad's
on here as well. You know, she said specifically, and Pharrell said this, I spoke to Pharrell as well, and he said, you know, she asked me for a Disney song. She wanted it to be like a Disney princess ballad. And then the lyrics, she's talking about sex tapes. She's talking about hentai, as in anime porn. It's very X-rated. And like that irony, that sense of playfulness, that's something you did not get from El Mar Querer or her previous album, Los Angeles. Totally, you know, definitely not on that one. And I think she was really like, that one to me has a ton of intention behind it and is really like daring people to be mad at it. There was like a snippet that was released and people were, you know, sort of gasping about the lyrics. And she was like, just wait till you hear the whole thing and hear it in context. And I had this experience with Chicken Teriyaki also, where I was a little bit afraid about the singles for this album. To me, the singles as singles are completely different than hearing them in context. And Chicken Teriyaki alone looks like TikTok bait, right? And she's been, you know, there's a dance and she's been posting the TikToks, and it feels very much like TikTok bait, like on its own. But I think when you hear it in the track list, again, it's all about the juxtaposition of the lyrics versus the music and hentai, the juxtaposition of Chicken Teriyaki going into hentai. And every time you think you have this album figured out, it swerves. So the sequencing, I think, is very important, very intentional, and masterful, really.
So what follows those two songs is sort of like an interlude. There's a few like minute and a half songs. What follows is called Biscochito. But there's a line on here, which I think is like a direct response to the previous two songs, where she says, I didn't base my career on making hits.
It's better in Spanish. It's a little clunky in English. Sorry. No, I agree. We should just play it. The couplet of her saying, I didn't base my career on making hits. I have hits because I formed the basis. No basé mi carrera en tener hits. Tengo hits porque yo senté las bases. Ya no tengo nada más que decir. Para decirlo hace falta mucha clase. Mi picante duro te marea. Hasta tu mamá le tararea. Que manda que me tire la mala. Si jara que me tira la buena. Habla bullshit lo que dice facea. Y mi mica pela ola de Corea. Yeah, she's basically like, I changed the game.
I think I'm increasingly feeling like the biggest stars are no longer going to be thinking in terms of classic singles at all. Like, they're just going to be thinking in terms of bodies of work, eras, whatever. Like, and that's fine. And a lot of times when we're talking about a pop star era, people are talking about singles. But I don't think that that's always going to be the case. I think people are going to be hotly anticipating a body of work from their favorite person. It's almost immaterial. And like, any notion of a single can kind of like sort itself out in the aftermath. You know, so in that, like a Bon Iver, whatever, you know, like whenever Bon Iver drops a new album, no one's going to be like, well, the single, like, that's not how it's going to be. And I think that's essentially what Rosalía is going to do. And I like that immediately after those two songs at that interlude, there's a song called G3N15, which is just like a straight meditation. It reminded me a little bit of some Kanye vocal manipulation. And of course, Caroline Shaw's on this too, doing vocal production. Look, I'm old enough to remember when people put out albums and they had different kinds of songs on them back in the 90s, you know, like that's fine. Obviously, plenty of artists do this. Rosalía is not the first person to put out an album that has different styles of music, et cetera, et cetera. But I did feel coming off of that particular run, there's a very, very pointed cool down and a very, very pointed uptick in kind of concept.
Yeah, I mean, she did say, you know, I wanted this album to feel hectic. I wanted it to be a roller coaster. This was my life. A, becoming famous. B, never being home. And then C, like living the pandemic. Like the track you mentioned, which to me essentially ends side A of the record, right, is G3N15. It's a ballad for a young family member in Spain who she, you know, didn't see for 2 years, essentially. And then it ends with a voicemail from her grandmother, right? Essentially saying, the life you've chosen is so crazy. Don't forget about your family. We love you very much. We miss you. What a complicated world you've gotten into. And then you have a little break. And then all of a sudden you pick back up with the title track and sort of more high energy. And I think you're having these whiplash moments throughout this whole album. And I think in terms of being a representation of someone's psyche, like this track list, this sequencing is top tier as a delivery system, I think. And yeah, it just works so much better front to back than it does if you pull out any one song.
Not long after that song, I guess you could say the beginning of side B, after the title track, there's a song called Diablo. James Blake shows up. Let's listen to a little bit of Diablo. This must be the other side of me. I think to your point earlier of kind of using other artists as a toolkit, I really like James Blake, but I have personally found it hard to listen to like 60 minutes of James Blake end to end. But deploying it as texture is obviously like, it's phenomenal. And she does it in a couple places here. Do you get the sense that she views using James Blake as a tool, using Soulja Boy samples as a tool, and using reggaeton history as a tool? Does she view them all through the same lens? Or does she think differently about the source material depending on the culture from which it comes?
I think it's all one thing. And that's one aim that I had in writing about this album and writing about Rosalía, is that I really wanted to sort of reframe her, not as an appropriator of flamenco or reggaeton or dembo or any one style, but she's not a biter. She's an all-purpose sampler. She's a collagist. It's all the same to her. This buffet of sounds, everything she's ever heard, experienced, seen is for the taking. And I think we see a lot of the most dominant artists of this generation in particular are that. Billy, Frank Ocean, Drake, Beyonce, Kanye, Rihanna. Again, you think of the A-list, the most innovative mainstream but a little bit left people of this era, and they all have that in common, I think. And the second part of that, the other shoe to drop, is that it has to be good, right? The pieces that you're putting together have to have created something new, something that sounds original, and something that's familiar, but ultimately still new, right? The thing I have, and I wonder if you do too, on this album is like, I hear it, maybe even the first time I heard it, I'm like, is that a reference? Is she covering something? Is this flow something I've already heard before? Or is it just sound familiar now? Like, you're disoriented, right? And you're like, what part of this is her and what part of this is someone else? And that, to me, is her greatest skill. Like, putting this all in the blender and then it's all Rosalía and you can't even remember what comes from where.
The person who is the best example of that, I think, in the mainstream is Drake, who basically has his own grammar. Like, this is the thing. Like, you've heard a Drake, like, you hear a new Drake song, you've heard it before. And that's not because he's copying himself. It's because he's virtually copyrighted a number of gestures, flourishes, patterns, even word choices, and then is recombinant in how he approaches them, making new music. Rosalía, I think, is doing that maybe more with textures specifically than lyrical themes or songs. But the thing that sets apart the songs on this album, even the ones that are a little bit simpler and a little bit less exciting, is her voice, her texture, and the production, whether it's effects or studio or whatever, the way that she is layered inside the music. It all feels of a piece. And maybe that's the thing that rubbed me a little bit wrong about some of those collaborations, is that it maybe took her out of a signature vocal presentational approach. Maybe that's what it was. Hearing Rosalía like being like at the fore and very direct and kind of like almost very staccato, I'm not sure that that's the strongest place. But doing something where she is deploying this arsenal of 10 or 20 different things and slithering kind of between those things, she's exceptional at that.
And I think she has her hands, what you're really hearing is that she has her hand in everything on this album. Like I was alluding to
it's
earlier.
Very
like,
careful. It's like, yes. Careful record.
Like careful. One of my favorite songs on here is Cute with many U's. And this has crazy drums sourced from Tayana, this Argentine female producer from the Mexico City dance collective Nafti.
It's like a Jersey club record or like a ballroom record.
Yes. And so they sent her, you know, a pack, basically, and in there were these drums. And then she deploys them in this totally bonkers way and then slams a piano ballad in the middle of it. Like, we should listen to that part where it goes from the cute chorus into her just belting on the piano. And that's the part that she told me, you know, she was trying to do Kate Bush, essentially.
And this is also the song that has the intro from the Vietnamese farmer, singing farmer, TikTok star.
Yes. And we talked about him in detail. You know, she was like, he comes up with the best top lines. Like, he's such a genius melodist. Like, you know, she was, like you said, like, she was hearing music and another tool and a palette in somebody else, in something somebody else might have just seen as frivolous.
This is like a person who not simply listens kind of like voraciously. It's not that. This is someone who wants to be in discourse. Something that agonizes me a little bit about certain segments of contemporary pop music and also certain segments of conversation around contemporary pop music is this de-emphasis of discourse. It's that everybody is trying to function in their own spaces. And I'm not saying like I want to go back to like Paul Simon's Graceland. It's not like that. But I feel like you're in this moment of intense globalization, of ubiquitous access, to actually deny the power of being exposed to all these different ideas, to be a musician and say, well, yes, when I listen to Spotify, Apple Music, the radio, TikTok, SoundCloud, whatever, yeah, I'm hearing all that stuff, but like, I can't touch it. I won't touch it. That to me feels increasingly disingenuous as an aesthetic position. And it makes me ultimately maybe more suspicious of folks who are resistant to that. Here's a person who wants to be in conversation with everything she's hearing and willing to take risks in order to establish her presence as part of this kind of like ongoing swirl of ideas. It's musically adventurous. It's effective. She's really good at it. And it also has like a certain moral valence to it of just saying, yeah, like the guy in Vietnam on TikTok, that's my peer. James Blake, that's my peer. Pharrell, that's my peer. Ballroom House, that's what, like, we are peers. That's how it feels to me. And I assume if any one of these people wanted to like bring her onto their record or find a way to absorb what she does in their space, I assume she'd just be all thumbs up.
Not to always bring up Drake, but I think they have one other thing in common, which is that they are open to that dialogue, but because of many factors, including their races and the industry and their talent, you know, there's some meritocratic aspect of it, but they just occupy so much space. A Drake feature throws the whole economy of features out of whack. So I think that by no fault of their own, they are so big and so powerful that what to them is a free exchange of ideas is not always fair.
Of course, of course. Although here's my one actual hot take for this episode.
All right, let's go. Pedro, turn the camera on.
Turn the cameras on. Turn the cameras on. Okay, here's my actual hot take. Rosalía is not that popular.
Okay.
And again, I don't mean that as an insult. I just was thinking of it in terms of like, okay, so a couple weeks ago on podcast, we did a reggaeton episode. And one of the people we were talking about is Rauw Alejandro, who is, I believe, Rosalía's creative partner. We talked about, I mean, romantic partner and has some creative contributions on this album. And one of the things that came up in that conversation, and I think has come up in the writing about Rauw Alejandro, is like, well, okay, how far can you pull reggaeton away from its traditions? You're making these kind of like big EDM influenced songs. At what point are you losing the kind of like crux? Rauw Alejandro is insanely popular. Like, insanely popular. Rosalía, by those metrics, I do not believe is as popular, and maybe as a result is not as, if we're going to talk in these terms, detrimental to the erosion of the borders of the genre of reggaeton as maybe the discourse that engages with her would suggest. that was on my mind as I was thinking about that episode a couple weeks ago, listening back to the Raul Alejandro record and sort of seeing like what the way that he's playing with the genre and then the way that she's playing with the genre. She feels much more like a tourist. And I know that has a very loaded connotation. For some people, it's positive, R.I.P. Virgil. For some people, it's negative. But there is a slightly more touristic way that she's working with these component parts, whereas someone like her partner is literally working from within and kind of like blowing out the borders from within.
I think that's really interesting. And I was grappling with this, and I could have written a whole other piece about Rosalía's role in the industry. Look, she doesn't have a top 40 record in the United States, yet she has billions of views on YouTube. We haven't really talked about her as a music video star, but she's that too, right? Like some of the best videos ever, probably.
For best videos, best outfits, best nails. Shout out Isabella, who opened her fader profile
with the nail
from
artist
2 or 3 years ago with the nail artist. My cuticles are looking dusty today. I should have done better for Rosalía.
Yeah. You know, so she's at once hugely popular and also not, right? I talked to the general manager of Columbia, where Rosalía signed Columbia Records, and her manager
in America.
Yeah. And her, who put out this album, and her manager, Rebecca Leon, as well. And we had these conversations, and they were basically like, look, she's a musician's musician. She's an influencer's influencer, right? Like, nobody noticed probably that 2 weeks ago when Kim Kardashian posted a photo in a motorcycle helmet, like that was a Rosalía reference. People are learning about her through other people in a lot of ways.
And again, she's Bjork.
And the other artist they compared her to and that she shares a label with is Tyler, the Creator. And I think that's a nice reference. And basically, like, Tyler, the Creator didn't become the star he is today until what, like 2 years ago, basically. Like, he had this slow build where he was totally shifting culture, but pretty quietly. And he didn't have the hit records, and he still doesn't have the hit
records.
Which is very cool.
Not that Tyler is not popular. I mean, he literally just sold out Madison Square Garden and a whole arena tour, but not in the conventional old understanding of popularity. Tyler, another example, an artist putting out a body of work, and people will sort it out. It will go into the algorithm in any meaningful way after the body of work is released. It does not anticipate the algorithm by creating work that it thinks the algorithm wants. That is, I think, correct about Tyler and ultimately correct about Rosalía.
And this is something we've been talking about for years. We, you know, you and I worked on that piece at the end of what, 2018, 2019. That was like, there's no more regular pop stars. That was the dawn of Bad Bunny as sort of world-beating megastar. The one quote I put in there from the woman from the label said the same thing. There's just not down the middle pop stars right now. That's not what the world is interested in. It's these niche superstars. And Rosalía is like one of the best and most popular of that kind of superstar.
Let's talk a little bit about the song towards the end of the record that has a Soulja Boy sample on it, Delirio de Grandeza. Sorry, that's, how do you pronounce it? You pronounce it. What's it called?
Pedro.
Delirio de Grandeza.
Let's listen to a little bit of that. And it's ridiculous, I got you so delirious. Kiss me through the phone, while I lick you just like licorice. And it's ridiculous, I got you so delirious. Kiss me through the phone, while I lick you just like licorice. And it's ridiculous, I got you so delirious. Kiss me through the phone, while I lick you just like licorice. Espero con el tiempo juntos quiero. So this song has a Soulja Boy sample, and this song also is like an interpolation, I believe, of a bolero by a Cuban singer, Justa Betancourt. Talk to me a little bit about it, Joe.
It's like a cover and a sample and another sample all smashed together.
Can I do a quick sidebar about Vistoso Bossas for a second?
Yeah, let's go.
Okay, so the Soulja Boy sample is off of a Vistoso Bossas single, or it's like a remix or like a remake of a Vistoso Bossas song. Vistoso Bossas was a girl duo, rap duo from Atlanta in the late 2000s.
2009.
Yeah, yeah. Like, first of all, shout out all my Rich Kids heads, all my Travis Porter heads. So Vistoso Bossas, if I'm not mistaken, and if you think I'm wrong, tell me. Vistoso Bossas were managed by CEO Charlie, who also managed 2 Chainz and also was one of the founders of Street Execs, and now is a kind of TikTok star helping
crypto people. Influencer?
Is he a crypto influencer? I don't know.
I mean, no. Vibes. No. Those vibes.
Oh, no. He's a he like helps people who are down on their luck. He's like a GoFundMe guy. You know, he's a kind of like, we met this person. They need $10,000 to like make their dream come true. Can you guys help? Shout out CEO Charlie. I see you killing it. Anyway, Vistoso Bosses, their song is called Delirious. There's a version that doesn't have Soulja Boy on it, but the sample here is from the Soulja Boy version of this song.
Yes.
Woo! Let's play it. This is Soulja Boy Delirious from Vistoso Bosses, 12-inch. Yada yada. Let's play it.
Man, it's ridiculous. I got you so delirious. Kiss me through the phone while I lick you just like licorice. I'm Hov back in 96 and you can be my Sasha Fierce. Baby, you so sexy. I love the way them jeans fit. Put you on my team, miss. Call you Miss Beezy. I'm Soulja Boy. Tell them I can make your life so easy. And if you don't believe me, please don't tease.
So this sample, Rosalía said she wanted, you know, Soulja Boy combined with this bolero. And you know, she tasked her co-producer, one of her co-producers on the album, Michael Uzuwuro, with finding this.
Michael has collaborated with Frank Ocean, many other people.
Beyonce, Earl Sweatshirt. Yeah, he's a sort of secret weapon of a lot of the LA studio scene right now. But yeah, this song is everything that she's doing, I think, in one package.
What's funny is I feel like a lot of artists who were trying something this ambitious would be much more flamboyant about it. And much more kind of like pick me about it. There's really nothing pick me about Rosalía. Is that fair to say? That's how it scans to me.
I agree. The one thing I will say is about flamboyance is that this record is extremely, extremely swaggy, right? Like,
yes,
it's like it's a rap album in a lot of ways. And I think we've been dancing around that, but the way she's borrowing, the way she's in dialogue, etc. And she's really spitting. Like, there's some of the hardest rapping I've heard this year is on this album. And there are a ton of ballads and little other moments. But I think the core of it is, you know, she's referencing Lil' Kim. She's referencing Tego.
Plan B.
She's referencing MIA, you know, and I think like there's a lot of that. And that's something you haven't gotten from her in the past, in maybe a little bit on the singles in between, but her basically being like, it's not a show off thing necessarily. And it's subversive, especially I think in the Spanish speaking world, for a woman to be as explicit and as, what do you want to call it? Like, sort of, she's just brushing off her shoulders like at every turn.
And so the kinship with Tokisha is actually makes a lot of sense. You mentioned. Yes. So there was a prior Tokisha collaboration called Linda. There's a Tokisha collaboration towards the end of this record called La Combi Versace. Let's listen to a little bit of this. So it's Rosalía and Tokisha, it's Pharrell and Tiny are both producing on this record. Like, it's, again, a very unflashy flamboyant. I know what you mean about the distinction between, like, flamboyance and swagger. It's a lot of swagger, but it's not very, like, call attention to itself swagger.
Especially not musically. It's not saying, like, look how smart I am. It's just it's basically saying, like, look how confident I am at how I'm pulling all of this off. She doesn't want to be patted on the back for being musically advanced. She just is doing it because that's her language.
Did you get a sense from talking to her that the 3-year break between albums was it COVID? Was it not finding the sound? Was it actually trying to pace things out in a way that a new body of work could actually land like a body of work as opposed to like drip, drip, drip?
I think it was all of the above. I think she was always going to take a long time on it. She's extremely exacting. Like we've said, you know, she touched every part of it. She produces drums, she produces vocals, she produces track, plays instruments, she sings. She had a very strict idea of the musical palette of this, right? No guitars, lots of keys.
Oh yeah, we didn't even talk about that. No guitar. For a flamenco expert, no guitars.
Yes.
Yeah.
Even the straight ahead flamenco song on here, Bularias, has no guitars. Even the bachata song on here, La Fama with The Weeknd, has no guitars. Like that all takes a while. I think, you know, she said she kept setting deadlines for herself and breaking them. I think COVID made that a lot easier to keep breaking your deadlines, essentially, because what were you putting out? But, you know, she finished it last year, and I think they took their time rolling it out. The last thing I'll say is that it's still only 42 minutes. It's also extremely economical. El Maquerer was barely half an hour long. Like, this is an artist who is making an extreme impact in culture in very pithy packages.
And it's a very dense, nutritious 40. You know, there's just so much. You listen to it multiple times for different things. I think you could have a purely textural listening. You could have a purely lyric, vocal tone listening, samples, and kind of like, I mean, the fact that Caroline Shaw is doing vocal arranging on like 4, 5, 6 songs here, this is a person who wants to hear a voice up here, a voice in the middle, a voice down below, and something that's like off in space, but you can still kind of make out the faint outline of it in the distance. It's just a beautiful deployment of sound. I think we should go out with the Weeknd song, which weirdly is like, it's a little hit or miss, TBH, but again, a bachata. And should the Weeknd be singing bachata in Spanish? I mean, Drake's done it. Who knows? Maybe. Why not? If you're going to do
texture.
If you're going to do it on a Rosalía record. Like, I don't think he should do it on his record necessarily, but sure, do it on a Rosalía record. Why not?
I think she liked the way his voice sounded on this, and it didn't matter sort of what he was saying or how he was pronouncing it.
From a purely creative point of view, like, that's a powerful statement to be able to make. And again, I'm sure controversial to some folks. I think there are probably some folks, in the same way that when Drake did it, some people were like, this really ain't it. I happen to think this is like potentially mid, maybe just more musically than politically. But did she talk a little bit about bringing him into this space? Like the conversations behind that?
Yeah, what I just said was sort of cribbing from her, which is that, you know, she likes the tone of his voice. She wanted to make a bachata song without guitars, and he worked for what she was envisioning. The only thing I'll say about the vocals, which I remembered her mentioning, but really heard it today when I went back and listened to these two albums, there's not a lot of vocal harmonies on this. There's lots of pitch shift, there's auto-tune, but it's almost always just one Rosalía, whereas if you listen previously, there's lots of layers of her voice that you're hearing, lots of harmonies. And I think having Abel on the song, having the Weeknd on this track allowed her to play with harmony without sort of breaking the rules of the palette she had set for herself.
All right, so before we go out with that song, let's do 60 seconds on a terrible thing that you did to me last week, which is that you recommended Hal's cola flavored seltzer in limited edition.
Wow. All right. We're gonna do this now.
No, we're gonna do it in front of everyone. We're gonna do a full snack episode. Like, this is like for the real heads. We're gonna do a snack episode. But I do want to say this was an emotion. This was like a hard for my relationship with you, this was a hard thing.
I'm ready to fight it. I think
I'll
start with the conclusion, which is that our palates are very different.
Absolutely. Mine is naive. And mine has been trained on the harshest, most viscous, most HF or HCFS beverages that Outer Brooklyn had to offer in the 80s. So, yes, I accept.
The other thing is, you're a big soda drinker, traditionally. I don't drink soda. I haven't had a soda since I was like 15 years old, like a Coca-Cola.
Damn.
I'll have an energy drink.
That was like the human nails emoji, which you just did. That's what that was.
So the cola seltzer has that funny thing where it's like, is this what cola tastes like? Like, I don't even know. I don't remember, but I like the caffeine kick.
It's like a Rosalía reggaeton song. Like, is this what reggaeton sounds like?
Yeah. Like, I don't know, but it works for me. Interestingly flavored seltzers that do not come across as all chemical are really near and dear to me, which is why I like the Hal's. What was your exact complaint with it?
First of all, okay, let's work backwards. The aftertaste, I could taste it, no lie, for more than two. I only had like a third of the bottle. More than 2 hours later, I could still taste it.
But you drink heavy Coke and you're talking about aftertaste?
Heavy Coke dissipates. It literally dissipates. This thing was like stained wood. It just like, it stuck to the, it was like, you know, the Pepto-Bismol commercial where it's like, you see the liquid like coating everything. It was like that. Also the cola flavor, extremely light. Like, you see how much liquid is like left in this bottle of Gatorade Zero. It's like, if the rest of it was water, it's that much flavor. It's like,
That's what I liked about it. It's the essence of cola.
It's not even the imagined essence of cola. It's not even right. Like, I feel like you've been deprived. Like, let me buy you a Cherry Coke player. Let me buy you a Dr. Pepper, something.
I think about it if I need to dip back into sodas, but I like to make up for it with chips and candy. So whatever, we're gonna do a snack cast. We gotta do a snack cast.
There's definitely a snack episode. The people want it. This summer. It's definitely gonna happen. If you haven't been noticing, I've been rating sodas on my Instagram story because I lack purpose and I'm on book leave and I'm looking for distractions. So if you want more of that content, there was a great Faygo review. Maybe I'll put them in my highlights. that's our show. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Email us at podcast@nytimes.com. If you want me to rate a soda or you want me, Joe, and Karen to rate a snack, I would be open to those suggestions, actually. I think we should do that. Or if y'all want to have a thread in the Facebook group or on Discord, I'll check in on those. Subscribe to podcasts anywhere you get your audio content, Apple, Spotify, Google, et cetera, et cetera. Our producer is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. We'll be back next week. It's not Monchi and Alexandra, but it is
Rosalia
and The Weeknd, La Fama.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches, but there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.